They returned to Babylon 5 just as they had left it, by the Destiny's Fist's bridge door through an impossibility, but this time they emerged into the station's control room rather than Medlab. As it happened, they emerged just in time to see Griffin, who was standing on the raised platform at the back of the room facing a large communication screen, say in a tone of exaggerated patience to the Earth Force general depicted on that screen, "Let me say this in short words so you can grasp it, General Carroll. It was not me. If it had been me, you would all be dead. Got it?" The person piloting my ship showed a great deal more restraint than I would have. "You say no one in Earth Force or the Psi-Corps was killed in the extraction?" "That's correct," Carroll, red-faced and walrus-mustached, replied. "But Regional Director Tremaine was seriously wounded, and one of his men lost a hand. And your man in the starship, whoever he was, caused billions of credits worth of damage to the Earth defense grid and..." "Your men illegally detained one of my officers and my daughter. Your men shot at my daughter. One of your men attempted to forcibly psi-scan my daughter, and you will do me the favor of informing that man that, should I ever cross his path, I will make him very, very dead. Now listen to me carefully," he went on, bulldozing over the man's obvious attempt at interjection. Griffin glanced at Zoner, who nodded. Then he continued, "You're a very lucky man, General. Everyone on Earth is very lucky right now. You're no doubt aware that one of your friend Director Tremaine's guests was, in fact, the Crown Princess of the Gamelon Empire." Yes, said Carroll. "Most regrettable mix-up with the..." "Shut up," Griffin snapped, "and listen. You'll notice the Gamelon fleet is leaving. That's because Princess Dessler was kind enough to persuade her father not to eradicate all life on Earth. I suggest you show some measure of the same kindness, or at least good common sense, and stand down your pursuit force before you find yourself in a hole you can't climb out of. The experts of justice are not about to let you haul those kids back to a detention that was unlawful in the first place, and if it's a fight you want, Commander Krontep and I will be more than happy to give it to you. I've been wondering just how many seconds it would take Challenger to disable a galaxy class." "It's not that simple, expert," Carroll blustered. "Fine, the detention of your daughter and her friends was a mistake. I admit that. Director Tremaine was a little overzealous. But we cannot allow a rogue telepath to defy the jurisdiction of the Corps in such a high-profile fashion. It sets a precedent that the current policy cannot afford to..." Amanda suddenly mounted the platform, pushed Griffin aside, and addressed the General with her Imperial hauteur cranked up to 9. "General, this is Princess Amanda Electra Dessler of the Gamelon Empire speaking," she said coldly. "As I tried to explain to your overzealous Psi-Corps officer before, the Earthman Devlin Carter bears the scar of my blade upon his face. He forfeited his life in single combat. It now belongs to me. Under the law and custom of the Gamelon Empire, he is no longer a citizen of the Earth Alliance. He is my property, to be disposed of as I see fit, and I do not see fit to give him away to the Psi-Corps." She folded her arms, fixed the flummoxed flag officer for a moment with a level gaze, and then added, "If your forces are so eager for annihilation, then they may come ahead and try to take him anyway. My father's fleet can be recalled at a moment's notice. I persuaded him not to destroy Earth. I hold no such compunctions about Earth Force." Carroll stared at her for a moment in utter astonishment. Then he cleared his throat and said, Galactic Court's precedents on the, Gamelon laws of combat are, somewhat ambiguous. Perhaps it would be best if we, suspended the operation. For the time being, you understand, to allow our legal division time to, research the, situation further." Amanda suppressed even the faintest hint of a smile as she replied coolly, "Perhaps it would. You understand, of course, that the man, Carter, is still considered our citizen. We will pursue all, the usual channels to, win his freedom from Gamelon slavery, which I'm fairly certain is illegal under the Constitution of the United Federation of Planets. Amanda's good eye narrowed. "Don't press your luck, Earthman," she growled. "My sense of irony has been stressed near its breaking point today, as it is."
Quite,
said General Carroll, whose forehead was in serious need of a mopping. "Military operations in this matter will be, suspended. We'll call a hearing before the, Federation Court to, decide this, matter."
"Well, that's mighty white of you, General," said Griffin, the sardonic edge still in his voice.
"Before you go, there's one other thing we need to discuss. Princess Dessler and her friends were forced to leave behind their personal effects while eluding your overzealous psycop and his thugs. I'll transmit a list of all missing items to you within the hour. I expect everything on that list to be delivered here, to Babylon 5, within 24 hours, undamaged. Understood?"
Of course," said Carol, whose gleaming forehead now really needed a mopping. The fugitive's property will, of course, be, impounded, but, the princess, your daughter, and, the others, they should, I'll see to it. Earth Force out."
"Well," said Griffin to the Babcom logo, "that was, most, satisfactory." Amanda turned to him, and just for a moment looked as if she might laugh. Then she simply touched his shoulder, crossed his owner, nodded to him, and left the control room.
"Interesting girl," Griffin remarked.
"Uh-huh," said Ruri uninterestedly. The small gathering in the conference room had just about broken up after Griffin's abrupt departure. Ivanova had returned to the control room to coordinate something or other. Major Kira had shown the duelists and Corwin's party to their quarters. Janice Barlow had just arrived from the docking bay with Edward and Ayn a few minutes prior. They'd all been warmly greeted and shown to the food. Janice had taken a cup of coffee and a Danish that appeared to be blue apple and cheese. They'd vanished quicker than expected. She took a quick mental inventory and realized that she was starving and exhausted, the adrenaline of the day's events having finally worn off. Mitra had come to a stop in her lap, similarly depleted of energy. She idly scratched the little mag's chitin and sighed.
"Have a bunny."
Janice looked up in surprise. Commander Johnson was holding a small ball of gray fur in his hands. She eyed it suspiciously.
"Bunny?"
"Don't mind if you do," Jer replied, placing it in her lap next to Mitra and letting it have an exploratory sniff. Mitra twitched but didn't move. She made a mental note to offer it a blaster power pack later.
"Never seen one before?"
"Most people on my homeworld don't like animals," she replied. "Maybe because all the animals are large and unfriendly."
Jer nodded.
"Bailey's pretty friendly, but he does like to hide," he replied. "He does seem to like your gizmo there, though. And since Major Kira seems to have taken off without you, I thought you might like to know that your quarters are in Red 1203.
"Thanks," Janice replied gratefully, giving Bailey a tentative scratch behind the ears.
The rabbit investigated Mitra one final time before departing, Commander Johnson following it. Janice shrugged and got up, Mitra tucked in the crook of her arm like the football it resembled. She stepped out of the conference room and began to search for the red level. 5 minutes or so down the hall, a touch on her arm stopped her. She turned to face a very familiar-looking young man.
"Miss Barlow?" the young man said. "'S me," Janice replied.
"Captain Benjamin D. Hutchins, International Police Organization. Caitlin's father. Do you have a minute?" Janice stopped and boggled for a moment before recovering her composure. Of course she'd seen the man before. On ISN, Network 23, and in her Galactic History Reader, that is. She'd never expected to meet him face to face.
"Shouldn't I be asking you that, sir?"
Griffin chuckled. Well, I don't know what you'd need from me, but I have a few things I'd like you to consider, he replied. And I think you can call me Griffin. Did Jer give you a room assignment? Red 1203, she said automatically. Great, Griffin replied. I'll walk you down there. On the way, you can tell me how you got mixed up in all of this. If you don't mind me saying, nothing Caitlin has told me about you indicated this sort of paramilitary resourcefulness. He smiled reassuringly. She smiled back. Despite her usual reserve, she found herself liking Griffin quite a bit. Anyway, it wasn't like she'd had that big a role in the Psi-Corps' raid, she explained. She had been pulled in by Durandal, asked to provide cover for Edward and Ayn, and she'd done so. She told the IPO chief as much as they approached her quarters. Griffin said, rubbing his goateed chin reflectively as they came to a stop outside Red 1203. Be that as it may, not everyone would have endangered herself to protect near-total strangers. And not many people would have had the guts to steal a Psy-Cop's personal transport, he continued. Wish I'd been there to see that. Janice grinned. Griffin looked momentarily delighted. I didn't think I'd get you to smile, he said. You seem pretty serious. Have to be where I'm from, she said. Now, there was something you wanted to discuss? For some reason, this topic shift seemed to please Griffin even more. He grinned, and then became serious once more. I notice that you're not injured, he replied, but it's obvious that you saw some action on your way here. That's an impressively mobile and functional set of armor. It's called a frame, Janice replied. Regal Arms makes them for the Hunters Guild and other colonists. To be honest, I've never thought much about it. Every hunter is trained to use a frame, and sometimes a barrier. It's a shield projector, roughly, from the time they can hold a weapon. Fascinating choice of world to colonize, Griffin commented dryly. If the colonists have to train like Spartans just to survive. But that's neither here nor there. I run a small police organization, as you've noticed, and my recruit-level personnel are going to need all the protection they can get. This frame concept interests me, because it seems practical and sturdy and yet not as bulky as CVR. CVR has always seemed unwieldy to me, sir, Janice replied. Griffin winced at the title, but nodded. Exactly. It's great for what it was designed for. Pilot protection in combat flight operations and emergency armor in downcraft situations. But it's not practical to store, it's difficult to maintain, and it's impractical for the field in a lot of conditions. It's the best we have, but sending jumpsuit-level officers out in it isn't perfect, he said. And that's where you come in. I think your gear is just what we need for our field agents. But if I'm going to make that happen, I need an aide to negotiate contracts between Ragol Arms and my own engineering concerns. I need someone who's sharp, fair, honest, and trustworthy, who's familiar with what Ragol has to offer and what it needs from the Republic of Zeta Cygni. Mining droids, Janice shot back. We've got these hideous old Corellian pit droids. They're worse than Rogue Booma. That could be arranged, Griffin said. I think you'd do quite well working for the IPO as a summer job until you graduate, and we're more than prepared to offer you an internship in college if that's what you'd like to do. After all, my recruits will need someone to teach them which end is up in Regolian body armor. Janice smiled. It gets easier after the first three times you try to put your shin guard on your forearm, she said. But, Griffin, you don't know anything about me. I'm 17 years old, but makes you want to trust me with a long-term career in your organization. Well, if you really wanted that proven to you, I could march you off and have Skuld administer the test of light, Griffin replied frankly. My gut tells me you're not ready for that responsibility just yet, though. What you do seem eminently suited for is a job that will show you what you're truly made of, what you can accomplish in the real world. You're obviously combat-tested. Pardon me if I overstep my bounds here, but I think you'd really like a chance to prove your worth in other areas. That's part of why I left Ragol, Janice admitted, nodding. I already know I can shoot wild animals. That doesn't require much of anything except good reflexes and a bit of luck. Griffin nodded. So, do you think my offer might help you along with that self-discovery? He said. It's not like I was going back to Raggle this summer, Janice replied with a tentative smile. I'll be ready to start as soon as I get my things back from the W, sir. Griffin beamed and shook her hand. Welcome to the IPO, then, Janice, he said. I'll have Ruri draw up the appropriate paperwork, and we'll find you an office somewhere. We might even have a spare shuttle you can borrow. Or perhaps we'll lose Director Tremaine's runabout. He grinned wickedly. After a moment, Janice shared in the grin and the laughter that followed it. The rescued duelists, except for the two spending the night in Medlab, were put up in the still-vacant diplomatic quarters in Green Sector, plush accommodations with all the modern conveniences a full-service space station has to offer. The suite Utena and Caitlin were assigned was slated to be home to the Minbari ambassador once the station was operational. It had already been decorated in the Minbari style, but fortunately the standard human-type furniture hadn't been replaced yet. Pretty swanky, Utena remarked as she sprawled on the couch in the sitting room. Man, what a day! I'm tired, but I don't want to sleep. Said Kate. She sat cross-legged in the armchair at right angles to the sofa, her Zatoichi unsheathed across her knees, with the sword care kit Sayanji had given her for her birthday balanced open on one of the chair's broad arms. Utena raised herself up on one elbow and said, Corwin really saved our bacon. I hope your father meant it about not being mad at him. Kate nodded. He did. He always does about that kind of thing. Good, said Utena with relief. I'd hate to think he'd be in trouble for being so cool. She looked thoughtful for a moment, then went on, I'm no good at making things, so I'll have to find something really nice to give him. Kate smiled a little mischievously and observed, I think you already did. Utena went a little red. Yeah, I shouldn't have done that. It wasn't fair to him. I mean, I don't want to give him the wrong idea. We've already talked about that, you know? Caitlin declined to involve herself further in the matter, and so merely nodded in reply. She was saved from having to make further comment by the door chime, which played a merry little electronic song. Come in, said Utena, and the bulkhead door swung up to admit Griffin. Oh, hi. Hi, he replied, smiling. I just stopped by to see if there's anything you guys need before I go back to Challenger and head out for the evening sector sweep. No, I think we're fine, said Caitlin. Her brow was furrowed with concentration as she rubbed at the blade of her sword with a small piece of fine steel wool. What's the matter? Griffin said, crossing the room and leaning down over her shoulder. Got a nick or... Oh, my. Utena looked over, curious, as his voice trailed off into a sound of amazement. Gently, he took the sword from his daughter's hands and held it up, inspecting a point on the flat of the blade midway along its length. Caitlin, he murmured, is this what I think it is? Kate nodded. What? Utena said. Griffin turned the blade over in his hands so Utena could see the small, circular black scorch mark on the flat. A burn mark? She wondered. A blaster scorch, Griffin said, nodding. When, Caitlin? This afternoon, Kate replied. One of the Corps enforcers took an aimed shot at Dorothy with a plasma rifle as we were crossing the quad to Dagger Disc. And you... I sent it back to him, Kate confirmed. I didn't think about it. I just did it. Put myself in the pulse's way and counterstruck it. It was just like an arrow counter, except a bit faster. Griffin ran his thumb over the mark and looked at the soot it left behind on his skin. Then he handed the Zatoichi back and sat down in the second armchair opposite Utena. The blade of the inviolate soul, he explained to her quizzical expression, Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu's ultimate defensive technique. The warrior's blade becomes an extension of his soul, sheathed in an invincible armor of will. With the inviolate soul in force, a plain steel blade can parry a blaster shot, a beam saber blade, carve a force field, cut or block damn near anything. The day the inviolate soul is manifest is the day all Katsujin Kenryu journeymen strive for and dream of. It's the mark of mastery. One who possesses the inviolate soul is ready to take her own students if she chooses. "It's imperfect," Kate said, as if objecting. "The blade was damaged." "Only superficially," Griffin replied. "That scorch will buff right off. I almost wiped it off with just my thumb." He smiled. "Kate, you sound like you're trying to talk me out of recognizing it. What's wrong?"
"I told you," she said. "I sent the pulse back to the man who fired it. It took him in the chest. He fell, and before we left, I didn't see him get up."
She lowered her eyes.
"I don't regret killing him. He would have done the same to me, and was trying to do it to Dorothy. But I can't take joy in my achievement if it cost a man his life, even if he was my enemy."
Griffin's smile widened. "Well, put your mind at rest and take that joy, then. No one died in today's incident. Trust me, if you'd killed one of the Corps, General Carroll would have made certain I heard all about it. In fact, I made a point of confirming that there were no deaths, nor any serious injuries. Enforcer armor is tougher than it looks." Kate's face cleared. She smiled gratefully at her father, saying nothing. "So," he said briskly, getting up and brushing down his pants legs, "get some rest and pleasant dreams, you two. Tomorrow we'll have to have a little party, celebrating your escape, and the fact that I'm not the last Katsujin Kenryu master anymore," he added with a grinning wink. "Good night, Kate, Utena." "Good night, Dad," they said in unison, and, smiling, Griffin left the room with a wave.
Did you just call my father Dad?"
Kate asked after a few moments of quiet.
Yeah, I guess I did.
Oops. Wonder what the heck I was thinking of." A moment after that, the door chimed again. Utena blinked and said once more, "Come in," and the bulkhead levered up again. Juri Arisugawa stepped into the room, looking somewhat rumpled and carrying Utena's Challenger duffel bag over her shoulder. Both girls blinked and got to their feet in surprise.
Juri, said Kate, "what are you doing here? I thought your group was spending the night on the New Orleans.
"They are," Juri replied, "but I had an errand to run, so I persuaded the Free Spacers to beam me over here. A remarkable experience, by the way, but I'm sure you've done it before."
Kate nodded.
"Mm-hmm. But what errand?"
"Well," said Juri, "before I left Morgan Hall to meet up with the others at Galaxy House, I stopped by Morgan 412.
She reached down, unzipped Utrina's duffel bag, and removed an item from within it, proffering it to Kate. Kate blinked, then her face lit up as she took the object from Juri's hand and hugged it to her chest.
Seven! She cried, delighted. "Oh, Juri, that's..."
She stopped, unable to go on, as tears trickled down her face. Then she stepped forward and seized the redhead in a hug as joyful as the one she'd given the stuffed tiger, before retreating red-faced to her chair and curling up with Seven held to her chest again. Juri smiled.
"You're welcome," she said. "I left a note on your bed telling you not to worry if you had made it back and found him gone. I didn't have room for any of the others, but..."
That's all right. Dad's getting all of our stuff back. But I was worried about Seven anyway."
"I thought you might, if it came to something like this."
Juri stifled a most unsophisticated yawn.
"Well, I must be getting back to the New Orleans. I'm exhausted."
"Why don't you just stay here?" Utrina asked her.
We've got plenty of space. Look at this place. There are two bedrooms in this suite. I guess the other one's for an ambassador's assistant or an attaché or something. Crash here and send for your stuff tomorrow. They're going to be bringing everybody else over here in the morning anyway. Jury looked as if she found the thought of not trudging back to the B-5 transporter room and through the New Orleans labyrinthine corridors very appealing, but politeness forced her to ask, "Are you certain you don't need the second room?" "After a day like this," Utrina replied, "I'm not sleeping alone if I don't have to. Now don't get up on your high horse again," she added, holding up a hand. "It's not like that." "I wasn't going to say anything," Jury insisted. "I appreciate the offer, and if you're sure I won't be putting you out, then I believe I'll take you up on it." She handed Utrina her bag, followed her gesture to the second bedroom's door, then paused. "Good night, Utrina. Caitlin." "Good night, Jury. Sleep tight."
Good night, Jury. And thank you again."
Jury's smile was unusually gentle for her. "You're welcome, Caitlin. Sleep well." "You know," Utrina mused quietly after the door was closed behind Jury, "I think she likes you, Kate." Kate went a bit red again, hugged Seven, and did not reply. "The court will probably fine for Earth," Devlin mused from his medlab bed. "Federation's ban on slavery and enforced solitude and all that." He chuckled bitterly. "We wouldn't want my rights being infringed, what?" "There are ways to avoid that," replied Amanda. "Before they have a chance to bring it to a proceeding, you could vanish from their sphere of influence entirely, adopt a new identity, and disappear into the off-Earth human population. Go to the Outer Rim, make a new life for yourself." She picked up his right hand from where it lay on the white medlab blanket, held it in both of hers, and examined it silently for a moment. Then she looked up at his face and said, "Or, if you wish it, you can renounce your Earth citizenship in a way that the Federation Court will accept, by becoming my husband." Devlin blinked.
"Amanda,"
he said, but his voice only rasped. He coughed and tried again, managing a whisper.
"Amanda, are you sure? I mean, messing about with me in a high school romance is one thing, but marriage..."
Her expression hardened a little. "If you do not wish to," she said calmly, "then, as I said, there are other alternatives. I will help you in any way that I..."
"Amanda, no. Don't misunderstand me," Devlin said. "I didn't mean I, but your father, your brother, they could overlook or even smile at an off-world, dalliance, call it wild oats or what have you, but... And Rina..."
"Kitarina Talaya Dragonar," Amanda informed him with some amusement, "may well be as much in love with you as I am, Earthman. Could you not gather that from our last trip to Toronto?" She smiled and went on tangentially, "You will have to explain this to me, because it baffles me. Kit has never shown interest in any man before. She rebuffs suitors, and with her looks she has had many, with the same lack of desire you would show for Klingon food. And along you come, not bold, not strong, not even particularly handsome, and both of us fall in train. How is this possible? What invisible quality do you possess that makes you so damnably desirable?" Devlin mustered a weak grin.
"I guess," he said, "some chaps just have it. I'm not very decorative, but I am reliable."
Amanda chuckled, leaned closer, and carefully kissed his bruised lips.
"I guess that will have to do," she conceded wryly. "As for Father and Garen, Father will adjust, and Garen has known from the start that this day would come. I cannot marry him, after all."
She smiled again, a gentle smile that didn't grace her countenance often, and brushed at some of his bristly blonde hair. No doubt he and Coromel, and Sniper too, are rushing here in tremendous haste and anxiety at this very moment. They will be very relieved to see both of us whole. You may not realize this, Earthman, but Garen is very fond of you. He already regards you as his little brother. I will have to seek his formal approval. He is my elder brother, but I have no doubt that he will give it gladly.
I don't know, Amanda, said Devlin in a tone of dubious weariness. Are you really sure you want to do that? Your people, your father's peers, your superiors?
Yes, Devlin, said Amanda patiently, knowing it was at least half the drugs that were causing him to hedge this way, his mind tired and disorganized from the shocks it had endured.
I am really sure. I do not say it will be easy, but look at what we have weathered already. If you are willing to accept that, if you can take that one more chance, then I believe we can make it work.
He smiled, a bit dreamily, and closed his eyes.
Well then, he murmured, squeezing her hand in his. I guess we might as well give it a shot then.
He drifted off to sleep, and Amanda stood looking at him for several minutes before gently disengaging her hand from his and climbing into the adjacent bed to get some rest herself. It wasn't the most sweeping and poetic of betrothals, she supposed, but had anything about their courtship been conventional either? It would certainly be memorable this way. Roger Tremaine left the Commandant's office with his face set like stone. This was not just because of the lingering pain in his head or the stiffness of his newly bonded shoulder injury, but they were on his mind as well, as the dressing down he'd just received as he made his way to his own office in the PsyCorps' New York Administration Center. He was lucky he knew that he still had an office, not that it would be his for much longer. The Commandant for the Western Hemisphere had used phrases like unmitigated debacle and unbelievable folly in the course of stripping Roger of his directorship and reassigning him to the lunar colonies. The rebuke stung, as did the punishment, as much as the wounds and the psionic shock themselves. And the hell of it was, he never had dragged the truth out of Carter. The damned blip had forgotten, or rather, the man who had trained him had made him forget, no doubt with his consent. It was a standard technique used among the Resistance. As a former Director of Enforcement Operations, Roger knew that all too well. Many Resistance cells had high enough level telepaths to erase the knowledge of where, when, and from whom their newest recruits had learned the things they knew about using their powers and deluding the Corps. A really deep probe, by several Psycops in concert, could usually dig the erased information back up, but there hadn't been time. And yet, as he sat down at his desk and began to compose his things for his transfer, none of that mattered to Roger Tremaine. The Gamelon's exceptional resistance, the robot's sudden, violent way of relieving Turnbull and Bougier of their impression that she was Asimovian, that extremely remarkable ship, and the accompanying extremely remarkable acts of spacemanship that led to the group's escape. The coordinated efforts of the Free Spacer Nation. All those things were interesting, but not nearly as interesting as three things he'd noticed in his own experiences, the after-action reports from his men, and the data gathered by Martine Leclerc, who had been far more useful to Roger than she had ever realized. The half-Minbari girl's unique response to a surface scan, defying everything the incompetent counselor thought to be possible, and therefore disregarded as an error in perception. The pink-haired girl's sword, which couldn't be drawn from its scabbard by the arresting officers, and her ring, which refused to come off her hand. The brown-haired girl's incredible mental discipline, and the report from Psycop Smythe that, when she'd cut off his hand, he hadn't seen her until after the blow. These things were very interesting indeed, and in the final analysis, Roger Tremaine didn't care that he was losing his prestigious job and being posted to the hind end of the Alliance. On the moon, he would have time and quiet to consider these things further. Yes. The next morning, Corwin Ravenhair was atop the gently curving upper hull of Dagger Disc, removing the jagged, broken remains of the comm dish in order to clear the housing for a replacement, when he was hailed from below. He went to the edge of the hull and looked down to see Utrina Tenjo standing on the deck, waving up at him. "Access lifts inside," he called down, "just like the one on the Wonder." She nodded, then disappeared under the ship, emerging a few minutes later from the access port back by the solar collectors. "Hey," she said as she crossed the ship. "How are you?" "Okay," he replied. "Sleep well?" "Terrific. You?" "Fine." "Good. Listen, I'm sorry about..." She trailed off, looking sheepish and awkward, her hand behind her head. Reminded of himself, Corwin smiled and let her off the hook. "Yeah," he said. "It's okay." Utrina grinned. "Well, can I give you a hand?" "Sure," he replied, tossing her a glare shield. "You know how to work a laser torch?" "No," said Utrina honestly. "But I'm a quick learner." Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword, Sixth Movement, Haunted Rose. The symphony will return with Reflections in Transition.